Burnaby.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded March 15th, 2023. Well, last week, Canada's Ministry of National Defence announced a review of our defence policy. Though only 5 years into the Liberals' 20-year defence policy update, or DPU, the DoD insists a new DPU is necessary if Canada is to, quote, be ready, resilient, and relevant to meet any threat in this changed global security environment. Dimitri Lascaris is a Montreal-based activist, journalist, and lawyer. He served as justice critic in the shadow cabinets of the Green Party of Canada, and likewise for the Green Party of Quebec. In 2020, Dimitri very nearly became the leader of the Green Party of Canada, finishing second in a tightly contested race with the now-departed Annamie Paul. Dimitri's interviews for TRNN are at therealnews.com, and his articles appear at his website, dimitrilascaris.org, among other places. This Saturday, March 18th, Dimitri will host The Art of Peace, Seeing the World Through the Eyes of Our Enemies. The special webinar is his way of engaging with Canadians before embarking on a mission of peace to Russia next month. Dimitri Lascaris in the first half. And there was a time not so long ago war profiteers were held to be exemplars of humanity's basest instincts, antitheses of virtue, the very worst of the worst of evildoers. They were rightly and roundly despised. Now, though, CEOs of Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and Boeing and Northrop Grumman and General Dynamics and all their lesser factotums are welcome and well-treated in the halls of power and major media TV studios alike. The Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal is coming soon, and it promises to hold accountable the manufacturers of these weapons that kill combatants and non-combatants alike through the testimony of witnesses to the destruction wrecked and the crimes committed against humanity with them. Brad Wolf is co-founder of the Peace Action Network of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, an affiliate of Peace Action and a partner of World Beyond War. He's a lawyer, former prosecutor, professor, community college dean, and full-time activist for peace and justice. Brad Wolf and attaching the human cost to the merchants of death in the second half. But first, Dimitri Lascaris and seeing the world and ourselves through the eyes of our enemies. Well, welcome back to the program, Dimitri.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Always a pleasure.
Well, it's always my pleasure, of course. Now, firstly, Dimitri, how do those wishing to take part in your Saturday webinar, Art of Peace, Seeing the World Through the Eyes of Our Enemies, go about that?
Well, if you go to my Twitter profile, which is at Dimitri Lascaris, you look on my political page on Facebook, you can find it. It's pinned to the top of my profile, instructions for how to do that. It's a webinar. There's a link there for registering. It'll be held on March 18th, 2023, and it'll be about 90 minutes long. I intend to say a few comments at the opening, and then we want to open it up for general discussion.
Well, and what are you hoping to gain from this? This is a pretty risky position, politically speaking.
Yes, it is. But far riskier, infinitely riskier, is the continuation of this war. And we are not going to bring an end to this war unless we learn how to speak to the people against whom we're waging it. The fact of the matter is, all relevant polling data, we can safely operate on the assumption that a large majority of the Russian population supports both the Putin government and the decision to prosecute this war. And that's just a reality, a geopolitical reality. Now, we can ignore that to our mutual peril, not just the peril of the Russian people, but to the peril of those of us living in the West. Or we can try to understand why and to facilitate a dialogue. Now, as I'll be explaining when we hold this event, I'm just one person out of the billions of people whose future is at stake in this war. I might not accomplish anything by going there. As I've indicated in my commentary on social media about the subject, I've never even been to Russia. I don't speak Russian. I'm not going there at anybody's expense other than my own. So I'm just one voice in a sea of voices in this debate. But if I can contribute in any little way to facilitating a dialogue between the peoples of the West and the Russian people so that we can find a peaceful resolution to this conflict, this existentially dangerous conflict, then I'm prepared to do that. And even if I don't accomplish it, I'm not able to make any contribution in terms of facilitating a dialogue. I personally feel it would be of great value to me just so that I can better understand this country and the people who support the Russian government and what it's attempting to do in Ukraine, and trying to, for my own personal enrichment, understand their perspective on the world.
Yeah, well, we're always told that one person can make a difference.
At the very beginning, when I was thinking about doing this, was Tamara Lorentz, who is a Canadian who's pursuing doctoral studies at the Balsillie School. She is an outspoken, passionate, extraordinarily accomplished and principled advocate for peace. She recently visited Russia. I became aware of that and talked to her about her experiences. And after hearing what she had to say, I was convinced that I too should make that journey. And after I made that decision, I began to reach out to some people in Russia through, you know, mutual friends. And I hope to be able to meet with people from the academic community in Moscow. There's a couple of people in Crimea that I've been speaking to who are from the West, but who've lived in Crimea for some time. Other than that, I mean, I really don't know what to expect when I get there. And as I indicated, this is entirely at my own initiative and I'm at my own expense.
Well, when you say that you wonder about, you know, why the Russians are so supportive of President Putin, when I'm looking at the Canadian media and talking to people and listening to people in Canada and listen to how supportive they are of the government line as it's fed to us and are lining up foursquare in support of the Ukraine coup government and all that it does without, it seems, any ken of the history of what's gone on in Ukraine since 2014 and what the government, before President Zelensky got in and since, have been doing in the east of the country that led people that know realize to this conflict in the first place. It's no surprise to me to see that the Russian people, surrounded as they are in support of the president, because what else can they do in the situation they're in? It seems an existential crisis for them, something that Canadians perhaps will come to understand better later.
I completely agree with you, Chris, but I think it goes way back. The levels of support that Vladimir Putin has, and let me just say, and I'm sure you know this, you can't have a rational discussion about Vladimir Putin and the government that he leads in this in our society. It's amazing. You know, the childishness, the stupidity of it, the simplisticness of it, it's frankly sickening. If there have to be reasons. We shouldn't just automatically assume that, you know, some 100 million or 110 million Russians out of a population of 140 million who support him feel that way because they're brainwashed. We have no reason to believe that we are any more in control of the truth here in the West. We are a heavily propagandized society than Russia, frankly. And if you look objectively, going all the way back to the beginning of the presidency of Vladimir Putin, there are perfectly rational explanations for why he enjoys this level of support. And I'm just going to cite, you know, three, and you can go to the statistics published by the World Bank, which is anything but a pro-Russian organization, to confirm what I'm about to say. When Vladimir Putin took power after a decade of humiliation under the drunken, pro-Western, incompetent buffoon Boris Yeltsin, who was essentially a lapdog of Bill Clinton and the neoliberals in the Democratic Party, the poverty rate in Russia was 39%. I may be off slightly, but it was approximately, it was almost 40%. By 2021, the poverty rate had plummeted to 12%. When Vladimir Putin took power, the average lifespan of Russians was in the range of 61 or 62 years. It was up around 70 or 69 years at the time that the Soviet Union collapsed. The average lifespan of Russians plummeted during the 90s, the decade of humiliation. And then by 2021, it had gone from about approximately 61 years up to 72 years. It was higher than it had been at the time that the Soviet Union collapsed. And another metric, a third one, which I'll cite to you, Russia was a financial basket case during the Yeltsin years. It almost went bankrupt. There was a financial crisis in the mid to late 90s. Today, even after sanctions being imposed upon Russia, which were obviously designed to destroy the Russian economy, Russia has one of the lowest debt to GDP ratios of any major economy. It actually has become largely self-sufficient. And it did this under extraordinarily difficult circumstances because of the economic pressures being applied upon it by the West. So when you look at these objective statistics, how can you not understand how somebody who lived through the 1990s in Russia, and I think it's safe to say that most Russians who are living in Russia today had some experience of that terrible decade, how can you question why they might have some respect and admiration for their government? Now, that is not to say that there's nothing to criticize about Russia's government. There's plenty to criticize about Russia's government, just as there's plenty to criticize in any major Western government. But to suggest that there is no reason whatsoever for a substantial proportion of the Russian population to be supportive of its government is to betray an astonishing ignorance of the readily verifiable facts.
Well, the economy, the Russian economy and the basket case you described during Yeltsin and that humiliating period is clear to everyone. But if it was just a case of economy, this war must be costing Russia a lot. And for people to support the move to go into Ukraine in defense, I still argue, of the East, which is never mentioned here, it's a costly endeavor. And though there's no guarantee that the Western sanctions would lessen any, if they hadn't have done this, because the sanction regime has been levied against Russia for quite a long time now, this is costing the economy quite a lot.
Undoubtedly, but at this and there's no question that for the Russian government, I believe the last poll I saw from Levada, a Russian polling firm which has been often cited by Western media, it's a reputable polling firm. The last statistics I saw, and they publish monthly statistics on the approval rating for Vladimir Putin, was up around 80%. So that would have been, almost a year into what the Russian government describes as a special military operation, an approval rating of 80%. Did the Russian economy contract last year? Yes. I'm sure that was a painful contraction for a lot of Russians. But as contractions go, it was by no means devastating. It was in the range of 2.2%. The IMF just put out statistics predicting, the IMF, again, anything but a pro-Russian organization, put out its predictions for economic growth in 2023. And it predicted that for Russia, there would be very modest economic growth, but it would be growth nonetheless. And by comparison, Russia's performance, if it turns out to be as envisioned by the IMF, will be impressively superior to that of two of the most important economies in Europe, namely Germany, which is predicted to have virtually no growth at all, and the UK, which is an economic basket case right now and is predicted to suffer a very serious contraction. And by the way, one of the reasons why the UK and Germany, arguably the most important reason why the UK and Germany are going to experience a very difficult year economically in 2023, is because the sanctions that they have imposed upon Russia and the belligerent posture they've taken towards Russia, which was a major supplier of affordable gas to Europe and particularly to Germany, have exacerbated an inflation crisis. And in fact, if you look at the statistics, the bankruptcy figures coming out of Western Europe, you look at the job figures that are coming out of Western Europe, you look at the performance of the euro, it is no exaggeration to say that Europe, and particularly its economic powerhouse, Germany, are being deindustrialized as a result of this extraordinarily irrational program of sanctions that the West has imposed upon Russia.
Yeah, rationality doesn't seem to be really high on the list these days in the West. And we see that the ruble is up and Russia has improved its alternative markets for its energy, especially even after, it must have cost them immensely to lose the Nord Stream pipelines in the way they did in those markets as well. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dmitry Lascaris. Dmitry's a Montreal-based activist. He's a journalist and lawyer. He served as justice critic in the shadow cabinets of the Green Party of Canada and likewise the Green Party of Quebec in 2020. Dmitry, very near by a thimble's width, became leader of the Green Party of Canada, finishing second in a tightly contested race with the now departed MP Paul. His interviews are found at TRNN, thebillnews.com, and his articles appear at his website, dmitrylascaris.org. We're speaking today ostensibly around Dmitry's planned visit to Russia. He'll be holding a webinar explaining that and more, the art of peace, seeing the world through the eyes of our enemies. That will be this Saturday, the 18th of March. What's the time on that again, Dmitry?
It's scheduled to be at noon Eastern time, 6 p.m. Greece time, which is where I am currently.
Okay, noon Eastern. All right. Well, and you go to dimitrilascaris.org to see more. And you mentioned your Twitter handle. Could you reiterate that so that those that use that can zone in on you?
At Dimitri Lascaris. So it's DIMITRILASCARS.
I watched just recently your interview on activism, The Source. That's a fellow, Zane Raza, out of Germany. And in that, and it was a very good interview, the title being the Reality is Ukraine is Losing. You mentioned sanctions earlier. In that conversation, you talked about sanctions as an act of war. Canada, too, is a participant in sanctions. We often hear in Canada hear about the American sanctions. We less often hear about what Canada is doing as well along that line. I've argued for quite a while that we are in a de facto, we've declared war on Russia. Canada has in a de facto manner. Do you agree with that?
Well, 100%, you know, Chris. I mean, you know, we're not only sending massive, you know, main battle tanks, air defense systems, artillery, ammunition to the Ukrainians. We're training their military forces, including, as the Ottawa Citizen reported, I think back in 2019, neo-Nazis who have infiltrated the Ukrainian military. NATO is providing real-time battlefield intelligence to the Ukrainian military for the purposes of targeting and killing Russian soldiers and destroying Russian infrastructure. We are imposing sanctions, which, as I mentioned, are designed to destroy the Russian economy. I mean, in what sense are we? Oh, and I omitted to mention that we are also, if not encouraging, tacitly approving of former members of NATO militaries who are citizens of NATO countries to go over there and fight on the front line alongside Ukrainian soldiers. So in what sense are we not waging war against nuclear-armed Russia? It's absolutely insane to suggest otherwise. And we're doing this, Chris, we're doing this without having had any kind of a meaningful debate in Parliament, in our society, about the wisdom of waging war against Russia, against a state that has more nuclear weapons than any country on earth.
Yeah, is that still happening? I know that, and I talked to Ken Stone of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop War, it was more than a year ago, I think now, on the, and correct me if I'm wrong, is it the Foreign Service Act or the Foreign Services Act about Canadians fighting in foreign wars in foreign countries, and that there being actually a statute in this country making that illegal? But even so, the federal government was turning a blind eye to that in the case of, well, of course, Israel has been an ongoing thing, but in Ukraine as well. Am I getting that right?
Well, it the law hinges, I haven't looked at it in a while, but as I recall, the law hinges on whether or not Canadians are being recruited in Canada to fight or to serve in a foreign military. Not necessarily to wage war, but to serve in a foreign military. And I don't think there's any real question, if you look at the facts, not just with respect to Israel, but with respect to Ukraine, that there have been people in this country who have been engaging in activities that could easily be characterized as recruitment on Canadian soil of Canadian citizens to go and serve in the Ukrainian military in the time of war. But whether or not the law is being violated, my personal opinion is that it likely has been violated by at least some people who have been encouraging, facilitating, and funding Canadian citizens going to Ukraine to fight alongside Ukrainian soldiers. Whether or not that is a legal violation, the fact of the matter is our government knows it's happening. Our government has done absolutely nothing to discourage it, let alone to stop it. They could easily adopt a law if the current legislation doesn't suffice, which would prevent Canadian citizens from participating in that conflict. But they've done exactly the opposite. They know that we have Canadians. In fact, there have been reports of Canadians who have been killed. Canadians have been wounded, fighting alongside Ukrainian soldiers on the front line. So in what sense, as I said earlier, are we not waging war against Russia just because we haven't sent active members of our military to actually fire at Russians on the front line? To me, that's
without a difference.
We may well have. Yeah, I'm operating on the assumption that the Canadian government is telling the truth, that we haven't done that. And frankly, I don't trust them, and neither should you. But let's assume they're telling the truth. Even still, the stuff that we know for sure is happening can lead you inexorably to only one conclusion, and that is Canada is at war with Russia.
Well, I don't know that Canadians, if they knew the truth, would be lining up to go over there with the, in the case of the Bakhmut battle, the life expectancy of raw recruits being in, measured in minutes and a handful of minutes at that.
Things
are not going well there. There's millions, or there's thousands of people dying on both sides, and tens of thousands have died already. But the happy jingoism continues in this country as though that these realities aren't extant. The Department of National Defense and Canadian Armed Forces open public consultations on update to Canada's defense policy to all Canadians, reads the press release I've got in front of me. This put out March 9th. By the ministers Anita Anand, and the Canadians government is saying that though they updated with a 20-year plan the defense policy in 2017, they're going to have to do it again because the situation has changed, is what they're saying. And they're saying because of Russia and Ukraine, Canada has to change. And essentially, this means to me that they want the Liberal government and the defense infrastructure in this country want more. They want more and more. What's your take on Minister Anand's announcement?
I think that this is window dressing. I think at the end of the day, the Canadian government is going to do what it always does. It's going to do what its masters in Washington wanted to do. And what its masters in Washington wanted to do is to increase its military spending, spend extraordinary amounts of money on enriching U.S.-based arms manufacturers, and providing legitimacy to America's imperialistic wars, one of which is taking place as we speak in Ukraine. I think that's what the Canadian government is going to do, and that this is nothing but a public relations exercise. Having said that, I do encourage people who are listening to actually post comments on this, and I might humbly suggest a couple of questions that you might ask in the course of, engaging in this discourse with the Canadian government. One of those questions is, why is it not sufficient for the countries of NATO collectively to spend an amount of money, U.S. $1.2 trillion, which is what they're approximately currently spending collectively on their militaries, that is anywhere from 3 to 4 times the collective military budget of Russia and China? Why is that not enough to keep us safe? How much more do we have to spend than Russia and China to keep us safe from these alleged threats that they create? 20 times? 30 times? Seriously? We aren't spending enough? Why is it necessary for Western countries, particularly the United States, but also other Western countries, including Canada, Britain, so forth, to have somewhere in the range of 1,000 foreign military bases when China and Russia collectively have about 10? Why is that not enough? How big does our advantage have to be? So that's one question you should ask. And the other question I would urge people to ask is, what does Canada benefit from being in a military alliance with European states, and particularly with the states of Eastern Europe? Now, let's imagine, Chris, let's imagine that the leaders of Russia and China lost their minds and decided that they were going to invade Canada. There's absolutely no reason to think that they have any intention of doing that. Do we really think that, Lithuania and Latvia and Poland and Estonia, that our being in a military alliance with these countries is going to act as some kind of a deterrence to us being invaded by countries like China and Russia? Absolutely not. And by the way, we are much less likely to come under attack from either China and Russia than any of those countries, particularly, the Baltic states and Poland with respect to Russia. So by entering into a military alliance, this is, if you just look at the sort of simple risk-reward ratio for Canada, we are placing ourselves at enormous risk that we are going to be called upon to go to the defense of these countries, which are extraordinarily belligerent towards Russia, which are doing everything they can to draw NATO into a war with Russia, whereas we gain nothing, virtually nothing, from being in a military alliance with them, because no country is going to be deterred if there were any country, and there isn't, which is interested in invading Canada. No country is going to be deterred from doing that because we have, we're in a military alliance with those states in Eastern Europe. So this is a completely irrational decision on the part of Canadian policymakers to put Canada in a military alliance involving an obligation of mutual protection with the countries of Eastern Europe. And I think Canadians should start challenging our government on explaining why that benefits our country.
Well, one explanation offered is, and it has nothing to do with Canada on its face, it says, quote, the reason for that is to continue to be ready, resilient, and relevant, three words you're going to hear a lot of, I predict, to meet any threat in this changed global security environment. This has the sights of the Canadian military establishment and the Liberal Party go beyond this country. That would be way too parochial. They are looking at the whole world. So we are going to take the world on our shoulders and we'll take on the costs associated with that, as well as $38.5 billion more to modernize NORAD over the next 20 years that they've already reported. That won't be enough. When you talk about window dressing in this release, Dimitri, they throw in, well, the Canadian forces are also involved in domestic missions with COVID and forest fires and flood and helping people cross the street and such, no doubt. So it seems that there's no end to the mission creep here, that the final gate on this progression will be a military nation.
But Chris, you know, that language you read, frankly, I don't even know what that means. You know, ready, relevant, and what was that other adjective you used that they use? I mean, what does that even mean?
Relevant, resilient, ready, resilient, and relevant. That is the tagline for this new expenditure, yeah. The DPU.
And it's just empty rhetoric. It's just a vacuous cliche. What does that even mean in real terms? You know, I'm glad you mentioned the fact that the Canadian military is often called upon to perform civilian tasks like disaster management. Why is that? Why are we calling upon people who have been trained to kill other human beings to perform peaceful civilian functions? If we were sensible about this, what we would do is we would create a civilian corps of professionals who are exclusively devoted to dealing with domestic needs like disaster management. There's absolutely no reason why we should be calling upon the Canadian military to do that. And I think the reason why we do that is exactly so that the Canadian government can then try to persuade the public that the military actually serves a useful purpose. What they never explained to us is why we need soldiers to be performing those tasks and why we can't call upon civilian members of the government or civilian members of the civil service to perform those tasks. People who have been specifically trained for those purposes and not for the purpose of waging war.
Well, the DART program, I question why it has to be a military program. And I'm in a back and forth on Twitter with this, with a very smart person who has the answers, but I'm wondering where those answers come from. And she says, and I'll quote her, I asked that very question about the military and these emergency response. And she says, well, advanced teams, military equipped teams, assess if there's a need to protect members of the rescue mission. So they go there with their, quote, specially trained CAF assets using CAF equipment who have CAF jobs. This sounds like a pretty capable publicist, although that's not how she bills herself. But this is the answer that you get from that, is that, well, we've got to protect Canadians on the ground when they're there to do good things, so the military must precede them.
Well, I'm at a loss to understand what CAF equipment she's referring to. Tanks?
I think the ones that make lots of noise, yeah.
Yeah, you know, the ones, bombs? Which CAF equipment? Why can't we provide the relevant equipment to a non-military civilian corps that has been specifically trained to deal only with things like disaster management, with the domestic needs of the population? That, I mean, these, again, the Canadian government and the Canadian military are very adept at using fancy phrases, which at the end of the day don't mean a hill of beans. They don't mean anything. We don't even know what they mean. They just sound impressive. There's absolutely no rational reason that anybody in the Canadian government has ever articulated for assigning military personnel to perform things like dealing with floods, you know, to perform dealing with blizzards, you know, some kind of natural disaster other than the ones I've mentioned that afflict the population domestically. These are tasks that should be dealt with by people who are non-military personnel who have been trained specifically and exclusively for that purpose.
Yeah. Well, Dmitry, there's so much more we could get to, but I know that your time is limited and so is mine. I just remind everyone, Saturday coming, that's March the 18th, Dmitry will host the webinar, The Art of Peace, Seeing the World Through the Eyes of Our Enemies. It's a special webinar. It is taking place at 12 noon Eastern Canada time, Eastern time.